Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Karl Rove's Fight Club, the title of a piece in Politico by Kenneth Vogel, Politico's chief investigative reporter. He investigated the Weaver Terrorist Group, a coalition of GOP money bundlers and kingmakers who helped Republicans retake the House in 2010 and have even bigger plans for 2012. We will discuss this difficult assignment for a reporter since the Weaver Terrorist Group follow the Fight Club rule of not talking about who they are and what they do. Then we will speak with Paul Starr, a Pulitzer Prize-winning professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton, who wrote an article back in January for The New Republic, "The Healthcare Mandate Really Was a Mistake," which argued that the president miscalculated about the courts, the politics, and the policy itself. He is the author of a new book, Remedy and Reaction, The Peculiar American Struggle Over Healthcare Reform. Then finally, we'll explore what the president and the Canadian prime minister said little about yesterday, after yesterday's Three Amigos summit. That is the contentious Keystone XL pipeline that is no longer about U.S.-Canadian relations, but domestic U.S. politics. Roderick Tremblay joins us. He's a professor emeritus of economics and international finance at the University of Montreal and was a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlements of the North America Free Trade Agreement. Joining us now is Kenneth Vogel, the chief investigative reporter for Politico, who tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence. He has covered politics and government at all levels, from small-town cop shops and school boards to state houses, Congress, and the presidential campaign, traveling during 2008 with the campaigns of Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Sarah Palin, and Joe Biden. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kenneth Vogel.
Hey, great to be with you.
And the Fight Club analogy about the first thing is you don't talk about it, and the second thing you don't talk about it. Clearly, a difficult assignment for a reporter. Do you think you cracked the nut? Because apparently this was the week where they huddled behind closed doors to discuss how to spend hundreds of millions to defeat President Barack Obama and congressional Democrats.
Yeah, that's right, Ian. It is a tough nut to crack. And the interesting thing is they reveal the presence and the existence of these ongoing meetings only after the 2010 election, when, of course, they had great success in coordinating to an unprecedented extent some of these, typically warring factions of the conservative movement and the Republican Party, bringing to the table groups that hadn't always played well together in the past, including the Karl Rove sort of establishment groups, some of which I should say were new, but also some of the Koch brothers-funded, more libertarian, fringy groups that were more focused on free market, libertarianism as sort of a pure ideology, or not interested in some of the electoral machinations that had driven the Republican Party during the Bush years, as well as pro-life groups, you know, groups that oppose abortion rights, groups that support gun rights. So these are very disparate groups that Karl Rove nonetheless brought together, and the reason why we found out about it is because they wanted to do a little bit of chest thumping after 2010 to show we had this great effect on the midterm election, swinging them in Republicans' favor and allowing Republicans to retake the House, and doing a little bit of predictive boasting about what impact they were going to have in 2010. And so we decided we would try to catch up with them and see what the status of their meetings were. And we found out that there was this meeting occurring. Actually went down outside of the office building in downtown Washington where the meeting is held, in the American Crossroads offices, which is one of the super PACs started by Karl Rove, and tried to spot folks coming in and out of it, and didn't really see a whole lot of folks that I could recognize, but could have been a different entrance that they were using.
Well, Kenneth Vogel, it comes as a surprise to me, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners, that within these Republican king-making, money-bundling circles, Karl Rove is considered an establishment figure.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he, of course, was the establishment and was the Republican Party to some extent during the Bush years. But afterwards, he kind of slinked off a little bit, was not particularly well regarded. Certainly the Tea Party movement in 2009 and 2010 saw President Bush, the Bush administration, and Bush's political operatives of course personified by Karl Rove, as an adulteration of conservative principles. And their movement really embraced a sort of free market, small government conservatism that they thought that Bush and Rove had steered the Republican Party away from. However, the Republican Party was adrift after Bush. They ended up in 2008 with John McCain as a nominee who many conservatives, frankly, were leery of, if not detested outright. They thought he was too moderate. And so what we saw was an opening that Rove and some of his fellow Bush-era GOP operatives, including Ed Gillespie, managed to seize on to create these new types of groups, super PACs and 501c4 nonprofit groups. And, of course, they were aided significantly in this quest to build a sort of shadow Republican Party by the federal court decisions in 2010 that really opened the floodgates to some extent for new unlimited corporate and even secret money that has funded this infrastructure that Karl Rove is the unofficial head of.
Well, Kenneth Vogel, you covered the Sarah Palin campaign in 2008, and of course, she to some extent made up for the leeriness that you just mentioned that the Republican right felt about John McCain. She also hosted NBC's Today Show and basically called for Republican voters in primaries, and of course, we're just watching as the primary results are about to come in Wisconsin, Maryland, and Washington, D.C. She called for Republican voters to be bold, which is another way of saying vote for Santorum, I guess. Is that dichotomy there? Because it looks like if Romney wraps this up, do you think that the Tea Party types that are also hauling in some serious money, are they going to be truculent about supporting Romney, or the divisions that you wrote about in your article, the Karl Rove Fight Club? Are they going to heal?
That's really the open question here, and a huge question for conservatives and Republicans headed into 2012, because of course the establishment, the extra party establishment, as represented by Karl Rove and Ed Gillespie and some of these other operatives, is seen as very much behind Mitt Romney, and some conservatives, Tea Party types, evangelicals, etc., who were naturally suspicious of Mitt Romney, also were suspicious of Karl Rove from the get-go, and believe that he, to some extent, had his thumb on the scale trying to tilt the playing field of the Republican presidential primary in Mitt Romney's favor. If Mitt Romney comes away with it, I think that you will see some of the big money that had coalesced behind Tea Party groups through the Koch brothers and others, as well as some evangelical Christian right groups, being a little bit reluctant to come to the table to support Mitt Romney. And if they don't come to the table to support Mitt Romney and are leery about going in with Karl Rove on some of his efforts to support Romney, it also stands to reason that they might be reluctant to take direction from Karl Rove and this Weaver terrorist group on some of the congressional races, and that could really threaten this newfound yet fragile truce that we saw Karl Rove bring together in 2010.
Again, I'm speaking with Kenneth Vogel, the chief investigative reporter for Politico, who tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence. So, Kenneth Vogel, give us an idea of the big players here. You've got Karl Rove, and of course he's got Crossroads. He's also got Crossroads GPS, which is one of those 501c4 nonprofits that allow the big donors to remain anonymous, all in the name, I think, of what charity or something. I mean, that's extraordinary.
Social welfare.
Social welfare, right. And then you've got the super PAC belonging to Eric Cantor, YG, standing for Young Guns. And Cantor seems to be, quite flagrantly ambitious, isn't he? He seems to have humiliated the Boehner on a couple of occasions and seems to be pretty much on his own reservation, isn't he?
Yeah, and what's interesting there, Ian, is that Cantor, who, for all extents and purposes, is quite similar ideologically to John Boehner. They're both sort of mainstream Republicans, country club Republicans is a term that you hear thrown about derisively by Tea Partiers and some of the more conservative elements of the Republican base. Yet, in spite of that, Eric Cantor has aligned himself with the Tea Party Republicans, the big freshman class of Republicans that swept into Washington on this Tea Party wave in the 2010 midterms. And you talk to folks who are Republican insiders, and they say Cantor goes where the action is. He doesn't necessarily go where his ideology takes him. He goes to where he thinks that there is a political will and there is political power. And perhaps as an extension of that, you know, using that rationale could be used to explain why he, the last couple years, has gone to the Koch brothers, donor confab, most recently out in Indian Wells, California, and was schmoozing with these donors at this event that is regarded as one of the preeminent places at which sort of conservative politicians are able to tap into these big donor circles. Of course, now that those big donor circles are all the more powerful because of this federal court decision. And lo and behold, Cantor has this new, it's not just a super PAC, he's got a whole network of new groups branded with this YG branding, which stands for Young Guns, which is his sort of self-created political persona. And he is a new player at these Weaver Terrorist Group meetings, yet some are already raising concerns that he's off on his own supporting Republican challengers or younger Republican Tea Party Republicans in contested GOP primaries, like the one that recently occurred in Illinois, where he got behind a freshman Republican running against a 10-term incumbent, and Boehner and some other Republicans were rather upset with this, but Cantor's candidate was victorious. And so you have to think that that adds some chips to Cantor's column, at least when it comes to big donors who are considering where the political action is. Cantor has established himself as a real player in that regard.
So, Kenneth Vogel, though, does that mean that Cantor and the Koch brothers, isn't this a bit of an irony that Rove and Dick Armey helped elect, I think, 60 out of the 65 freshmen in those that were elected in 2010 into the House to change it Republican were Tea Party, I think. Are they going to now you've got Cantor and the Kochs wanting to elect more Tea Party people? Is Rove out of the business? And what is the choice? Why would the Kochs prefer these Tea Party Republicans as opposed to the traditional ones?
Well, I think depending on who you talk to, you hear two very different explanations. Certainly, liberals and critics of the amount of money that is now flowing into politics see some self-interested motivation behind the Koch's decisions and the Koch's political efforts, suggesting that some of the folks who they have helped elect are more likely to enact legislation that would boost their bottom line, that being sort of most acutely chemicals and oil and energy businesses that they have huge stakes in. Then you talk to Koch sympathizers, and they say, no, for decades the Kochs have been at the leading edge of the sort of libertarian wing of the Republican Party, and they want to elect candidates that share their small government, free enterprise first mentality, and those may happen to be the candidates who also are going to oppose the types of regulation that are onerous on the Koch's businesses, but that is merely a side effect, and they point out that in some cases the Kochs have opposed measures that could help them, such as ethanol subsidies, of which they are a leading critic.
Well, but surely if that were the case, Kenneth Vogel, the Kochs would have supported Ron Paul, which they clearly haven't, if that's their ideological predilection.
Yeah, that's a good point, and certainly Ron Paul has had trouble making inroads at all with big money types in the Republican Party. You saw for a little bit there were some Silicon Valley libertarians and San Francisco libertarians who were supporting a super PAC that favored Ron Paul. But Ron Paul, in many ways, is as close to the Obama model of fundraising, that being collecting lots of small donations, not necessarily from wealthy people, and pooling them to make a larger pot that enables him to make a difference in conservative politics. But you're right, he has had no support from the Koch brothers or others who have long supported the libertarian movement in American politics.
So let's just go through some of the amounts of money that these GOP groups that belong to the Fight Club that you've been uncovering, and Weaver Terrace being Karl Rove's home address in Washington, D.C. $300 million is Crossroads' target for this election. $200 million is the target for the Kochs. $200 million. $50 million is the target for the Chamber of Commerce. And then there are other groups: Americans for Job Security, Americans for Tax Reform, which is an anti-abortion rights group, and the Republican Jewish Coalition. They've already been meeting with Adelson and Norm Coleman and company. The indications there are that Adelson's going to throw a lot of money Romney's way. Isn't there a sea change there?
Yeah, and they're certainly hoping that some of these groups that would seem to be sort of from different factions will nonetheless come together behind whoever the eventual Republican nominee is, or the group supporting the eventual Republican nominee, who at this point appears almost certain to be Mitt Romney. Nonetheless, there are some of these groups that are sort of wild cards, including the groups that are backed by the Koch brothers, such as Americans for Prosperity, which you mentioned, the 60-plus Association, which is a group that sees itself as the conservative alternative to AARP, the American Association of Retired Persons, the American Future Fund, Americans for Limited Government. All these groups are registered under Section 501c4 of the tax code, which allows them to accept unlimited sums without disclosing their donors. Of course, we should add that there was a district court decision in Washington, D.C. that was handed down just Friday evening that could change that and could require some of these secret donor-funded groups to disclose who their donors are who fund the very specific types of election ads. So that's sort of a wild card that's out there. I don't envision that decision having an impact before the 2012 election. Nonetheless, that could change the way that that money and corporate money and secret money is flowing into politics right now.
And what about these other players that were very influential in 2010, Grover Norquist, Americans for Tax Reform, and the Club for Growth? What kind of money are they talking about, and who are they throwing their money behind?
Well, the Club for Growth is another good example, because they've long been sort of regarded as rabble-rousers in the Republican Party, and they have supported conservative challengers to incumbent Republicans in primaries, and they say that they're going to continue to do that. They were one of those ones that surprised a lot of people after the fact, after the 2010 midterm elections, when these Weaver Terrace meetings were sort of revealed and Karl Rove and his cohorts bragged about all these disparate groups that they brought to the table. It raised a lot of eyebrows when it was revealed that the Club for Growth was among them, because they're not regarded as playing particularly well with the Republican establishment. And when I put this to the president of the Club for Growth, a former congressman, Chris Jacola, from Indiana, he said, well, we're probably not going back to those meetings anytime soon. We might go back to them come the general election, but right now we're very focused on these primaries, including primaries, intra-Republican party primaries, where their goal is to pull the Republican Party further to the right. That's really the distinction between groups like the Club for Growth and some of the Koch brothers-funded groups and the Rove groups. The Rove groups and those in the establishment are really of a pragmatic mentality. They want to win first and foremost. The ideology is secondary. If they have to field a moderate candidate, like, say, a Mike Castle, the former congressman who lost that Republican primary to Christine O'Donnell, the Tea Party favorite in Delaware in 2010, they would rather have a moderate. If it's a conservative state, they would rather have a free market conservative. And the Kochs and Club for Growth and some of these other groups see the Rove mentality, that pragmatism, as sort of anathema to the founding principles of conservatism. those are the fault lines that we're looking at heading into 2012.
Well, just in closing, Kenneth Vogel, what about these groups like Themis or Themis, or whatever, I'm not sure the pronunciation, and Data Trust? It seems, in terms of targeting and these vast lists of voters and their tastes and habits, what they read, what restaurants they go to, the whole, the enormous amount of data mining has been going on. It seems that Romney's already employing this technology, isn't he?
Yeah, he is trying to, and what he's doing is more of a social media advertising type of tactic, and that is useful. That's certainly useful at this stage where you're trying to identify, you're trying to basically convince those who are on the fence to support you, and you're doing that by using all this data to determine sort of where you're what the universe of folks who might be persuadable to come on board and convince you. However, when you get to the general election, what you need are these much more vast lists that include all this commercial data, which is very expensive, not just maintaining the list, but buying the commercial data to supplement the list, stuff like magazine subscriptions, like you mentioned, concealed carry permits for conservatives, there's just a wealth of these things, and that's how you get out the vote, because it's not enough to have someone's email address or Facebook profile if you want to send people door-to-door determining which doors are the ones that they should be knocking on to try to drive out the vote for their candidate in the general election. And that's where you get into these voter targeting, micro-targeting efforts like Themis and Data Trust, stuff like the RNC has been trying to do. And that's really where, if you talk to political professionals, elections are won and lost.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Kenneth Vogel.
Yeah, it was my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Kenneth Vogel, the chief investigative reporter for Politico, who tracks the confluence of money, politics, and influence. He has covered politics and government at all levels, from small-town cop shops and school boards to state houses, Congress, and the presidential campaign trail, traveling during the 2008 campaign with Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and Sarah Palin, and Joe Biden. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about whether or not the healthcare mandate really was a mistake. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Starr, a Pulitzer Prize-winning professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton. He's also the co-editor with Robert Kuttner and co-founder with Robert Kuttner and Robert Reich of The American Prospect. His book, The Social Transformation of American Medicine, won the 1984 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction, as well as the Bancroft Prize. In 1993, he was a senior advisor for President Bill Clinton's proposed health care reform plan, and he has an article at The New Republic, The Healthcare Mandate Really Was a Mistake. And his latest book is Remedy and Reaction, The Peculiar American Struggle Over Healthcare Reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Starr.
Glad to be with you, Ian.
And back in January, you wrote in The New Republic that the healthcare mandate really was a mistake, and you argued that the president miscalculated about the courts, the politics, and the policy itself. And this is before the Supreme Court got their, I got with their hands on it, or I don't know whether that's the right analogy, but ripped into it. I guess it's if there's any vindication to feel, it's not particularly satisfactory. What's your sense of where this is going to end up in terms of a ruling?
Oh, I don't know how Anthony Kennedy is going to vote. I was there in the courtroom for the oral argument on the individual mandate. And it went very badly, I would say, in the first hour. But by the end, you know, there was great uncertainty, I think, really, as to how Kennedy would come out. But look, let me just backtrack a bit. I support the law. I believe it is constitutional. But during the debate about the legislation, I argued that the mandate was a mistake. It was a political mistake. I was afraid that it would stir up a backlash. I was afraid that it would create an adversarial relationship between the government and the people it was trying to help, the people who are uninsured. I'd done radio shows with calls from people who weren't really right-wing, but who thought the mandate was going to end up forcing them to pay money they couldn't afford or send them to jail. And I'd explain, well, there are going to be subsidies in the law, and many people just wouldn't believe it. And I realized there's a lot of distrust out there. And so I started to take a look at how other countries deal with this. I started to think, is there some way that we could have a safety valve, that we could have an opt-out? And I became convinced that, yes, we could. The mandate really wasn't essential. And if you step back and think about other programs, not all health insurance programs are mandatory. In Medicare, Part B, the physician's coverage, is voluntary. And the prescription drug coverage is voluntary. They work because they're overwhelmingly such good deals. People don't turn them down. And that's the first thing you have to consider. How good a deal is a program? And actually, under the Affordable Care Act, the subsidies for low-income people are very good, and that will drive most of the new coverage. The mandate itself has some effect, but I'm not convinced it has all that much effect. And here's one thing that most people do not understand about the mandate. It's not really a mandate. It's very lightly enforced. As one of the appellate judges said, this is a mandate that depends on voluntary compliance. No one's going to go to jail. The government is not going to garnish anybody's wages. It's not going to seize any property. There's none of the enforcement power as there is for taxes. There's only one thing the government can do to collect the fines if you don't insure, and that's to withhold a tax refund. And that's not much enforcement power.
So why did the administration then fall victim to its own semantical trap? In other words, why use that word mandate? If indeed, and I wondered during these arguments why nobody proffered what you just said, which is really, they're not really strict mandates because, as you pointed out, there are no liens, there are no IRS heavy-handed tactics. It's the you know, all that would happen is you would have less of a tax refund.
Yeah, well, from the standpoint of the law, if the court were to uphold the mandate, Congress could, of course, later increase the penalties. So I think the court has to consider the mandate as a policy in and of itself. Actually, let me just amend that. What people call the mandate under the law actually refers to two separate provisions in the statute. One of the provisions says that people have an obligation to maintain a minimum level of insurance coverage. The other provision sets these penalties, which, as I say, are very lightly enforced, but it sets the penalties. It is conceivable that the court could strike down the mandate, the requirement to maintain coverage, and leave the penalties. That is possible, and I think Justice Roberts almost hinted at that possibility at one point. I don't think this is very likely, but it is something that I think hasn't received enough discussion.
Well, of course, the Paul Clement, arguing for the 26 states, said if you struck down the mandate, the whole bill is gutted. Why didn't they think? Why, for example, didn't they use tax credits instead of this mechanism that they've come up with? Wouldn't that have avoided any legal challenge?
Well, the subsidies for insurance are in the form of tax credits, and they are a tremendous inducement to take out insurance,
right.
To use the new health insurance exchanges, and I really believe that is the fundamental force that would drive increased levels of insurance coverage. But let me explain my alternative that I proposed while the law was under consideration. I couldn't get anybody's serious attention on this. But I thought of the device that's used in the German health insurance system. And in the German health insurance system, people can opt out of the public or the statutory insurance funds. But if they do that in Germany, they opt out for life. They can't come back in. And I thought, well, that's too harsh, but why don't we make it a long-term opt-out? You can opt out, no penalty, but for 5 years, you'd have to stay outside the program, and that would mean you wouldn't be eligible for the subsidies, you wouldn't be eligible to use the insurance exchanges, you couldn't necessarily get a policy with no pre-existing conditions. You could look for insurance, it just wouldn't have all the benefits of the law. So you'd be no worse off than before. But I believe that if you structured the opt-out as a long-term opt-out, relatively few people would actually take it. They'd have to sign a form on their taxes, and I think people would be reluctant to waive those rights. So I believe you'd actually get a very good result in terms of people complying with the program and getting insurance, but you'd do it without the compulsion. And I think it would have obviated the whole case before the Supreme Court.
So, again, Paul Starr, Pulitzer Prize-winning professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton. He was a senior advisor to President Bill Clinton's proposed health care reform plan, and he has an article at the New Republic, The Healthcare Mandate Really Was a Mistake, and his latest book is Remedy and Reaction, The Peculiar American Struggle Over Healthcare Reform. So the kind of Tea Party, don't tread on me, people who are particularly angry about this, and it's worth noting that the Kaiser Foundation has shown that there's overall support for the Affordable Care Act, but the one aspect of it that's unpopular is the individual mandate. And again, I'm trying to figure out how, nobody can say that the Obama administration done a great job selling this. A lot of the good parts of it are backloaded, so people won't really feel the benefits. I think a lot of people pre-existing conditions and having kids at home should be supporting it because they have real world experience with it. But the two things that bother the right in this are the notion that one year you're subsidizing freeloaders, and two, that big government is telling you what you have to do. It seems like those could have been avoided. For example, go ahead.
Yeah, I do think the mandate could have been avoided. I think the mandate is kind of like waving a red flag in front of a bull. It does epitomize for many people government overreach, and that was what I was worried about and why I thought we should look for alternatives. I very much want to see this legislation succeed. I want to see it have a chance. I think once it did go into effect, people would understand it and would see that it's a good thing. But we may never get there because of the opposition and because of the court decision.
But in terms of the pool of uninsured, which this plan, and it did come out of the insurance companies, if you will. I mean, the president initially talked about a public option. He never embraced single payer. It's difficult to know how serious he was about a public option. But the long and the short of it is, he went this route, and this, of course, guarantees insurance companies an awful lot of new customers. But then, how do you pay for these new customers?
But let me just say something. The insurance industry did not support the legislation. They never took any position. The big insurance companies fought against it. They spent more than $80 million at the end on advertising to defeat it. So don't identify this with the insurance industry.
Right. I thought they initially supported, but then they turned against it. That's not true.
They never supported it. They were unable, unlike the hospitals and the pharmaceuticals. This is all in my book, Remedy.
Right. I obviously need to read your book, clearly. But go ahead.
Some of the other interest groups were able to come up with a list of things that they wanted, and they went in to the White House, they went in to see Max Baucus, and they got a deal. The insurance industry was never able to resolve its own internal differences among different insurance companies. Uh-huh. They were never able to work out a list of the three things or four things that they wanted. They never got a deal. And in the end, of course, I don't know if you remember this, but back in late 2009 and 2010, the administration turned very sharply against the insurance industry.
Well,
I think that
the same thing happened, didn't it? It was Clinton to a lesser extent, right?
Worse.
Yeah, I mean,
business turned altogether against.
Right, with Harry and Louise or whatever. Yeah. But what about the options that weren't taken, particularly expanding Medicare and stuff like that? Why did they go this route? Most progressives think it was just powerful lobbyists overwhelmed the idea of single payer or even the public option or expanded Medicare.
Well, expanding Medicare has many virtues, and I think if the Supreme Court strikes down the mandate and this whole law, including the Medicaid expansion, expanding Medicare is going to get a lot more attention because it'll be the only route available at the national level. But the problem with expanding Medicare is, well, there's several problems. First of all, many seniors believe that Medicare is just for them, and they are not going to be enthusiastic about opening up Medicare to others. The Medicare program pays hospitals and doctors less than private insurers. And so the hospitals and the doctors don't like the idea of shifting populations from private insurance to Medicare. And what makes this especially complicated is that Medicare payments are particularly low in relation to private insurance payments in some areas, for example, Iowa, Minnesota, and even the liberal representatives from those states have heard from their hospitals that say, if we move to Medicare and Medicare rates, we're going to become insolvent. We're going to go broke. And so you've got some actually very liberal representatives from those states who are not enthusiastic about expanding Medicare. There are all of these complications. I'm not saying that we couldn't get over this, over these difficulties. It's not easy. These other routes that have been at the center of political attention have been easier to sell to the great variety of interests and to the public at large.
Sure, I frankly think that it's going to be tough no matter what you come up with revisiting this. I mean, some Democratic strategists like Bob Schrum are saying if the Supreme Court strikes this down, it'll be great for the Democratic base. They'll be all riled up and come out to vote. That seems absurd to my mind. I think it'll be a humiliation and a defeat. And people in this country, nice guys finish last. You want people, American voters want people that are effective, not well-meaning.
I agree with you. It'll be very demoralizing. And I don't see how you can spin it as a good thing.
So, but just to go back though to the current mechanism that's in the balance here. My understanding is that the very people that you'd be trying to bring into the uninsured, the 40 million or 50 million now it is, I believe, that you're trying to bring in are mostly people on the lower income end. And I'm not sure that do they file taxes? Would you be able to have that ability to withhold tax refunds?
Well, let me just clarify something. If you have an income below the tax threshold, you're not subject to the mandate anyway.
I see.
Okay, the mandate does not affect them at all. The mandate also has a hardship exemption. There hasn't been enough discussion about this. If health insurance, even after the subsidies, would cost more than 8% of your income, the mandate does not apply. You're exempt from it. There's mm-hmm. also a religious exemption. There are a number of other exemptions. It turns out, actually, when you go through the numbers, not that many people would be subject to the mandate. That's another irony of the whole thing.
Well, all I can say, Paul Starr, is I wish they were listening to you, and I wish your voice had been available all around the country in these last months, because Most of the points that you've, in fact, everything you've told us tonight should have been what the White House have been saying for in their defense around the clock.
Well, there's been great reluctance to discuss this forthrightly, and I think it's been a very big mistake. Goes back to the whole question of whether there should have been a mandate in the law. And let me just say something. You know, it's hard to wind back the clock, remember exactly what was going on.
Right.
During the debate on the legislation, there wasn't much of a focus on the mandate. There was a lot of discussion about the public option. There was a lot of discussion about abortion coverage. There were many other things that got attention. But the mandate was not the focus of much news coverage. And I think many Democrats, including in those in the White House, were lulled into overconfidence because originally the mandate was a Republican idea.
Sure.
It was a conservative idea. So who expected them to turn around and repudiate it and say it was unconstitutional?
Well, that's exactly what Mitt Romney's doing right now.
It's amazing.
Yeah, he's running from the word mandate like it's a vampire.
And of course, he was not only the one to pass the mandate for the first time in a state, but he made it clear that he thought that was a national model.
Sure. Yeah. Well, look, I thank you for joining us here today, Paul Starr.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Starr, Pulitzer Prize-winning professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton. He's also the co-editor with Robert Kuttner and co-founder with Robert Kuttner and Robert Reich of The American Prospect. His book, The Social Transformation of American Medicine, won the 1984 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction, as well as the Bancroft Prize. In 1993, he was the senior advisor for Bill Clinton's proposed healthcare reform plan, and he had an article at The New Republic, The Healthcare Mandate Really Was a Mistake. And his latest book is Remedy and Reaction, The Peculiar American Struggle Over Healthcare Reform. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about what went on in the White House between the president and the Canadian prime minister. Hold on, you don't have to suffer. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roderick Tremblay, a professor emeritus of economics and international finance at the University of Montreal. He served as president of the North Economics and Finance Association, president of the Canadian Economic Society, was a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlements of the North American Free Trade Agreement, and his books in English include The New American Empire and his latest, The Code for Global Ethics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roderick Tremblay.
Good afternoon. Nice to talk to you in L.A.
Good to talk to you as well, Roderick. We don't know what went on behind closed door, obviously, at the White House. When the Three Amigos yesterday did their press conference, it was pretty clear that they're all dealing with domestic politics back home. That's just the nature of it. The Mexican president really went out of his way to talk about how assault weapons are freely available in the United States, and they've been pouring in hundreds of thousands of responsible for the death of 50,000 Mexicans. And you know that the president didn't want to hear that because the Democrats are scared to death of even going in any way putting a toe in the water in terms of gun control, even though the Mexican president pointed out that since they overturned the assault weapons ban, this flood of weapons has happened. Prime Minister Harper, of course, is very Obama have gone out of their way to say what a great personal friendship they have. But clearly, Harper's not happy about the president's cancellation of the Keystone XL.
Well, as you mentioned, the table, there's a lot of things on the table. It's a bit unfortunate that these three heads of state only took one day to, maybe less than one day, to discuss so many important issues for these three countries. You have to remember that Canada is the largest trade partner of the United States. Many Americans don't know that. It's not China. It's Canada, which is the most important trader with the United States, from oil, cars, computers, whatever you name them. And we are talking about $600 billion a year of trade between the two countries. If you include Mexico, then you reach $1 trillion of trade between these three countries. And that meeting in Washington between Mr. Calderon, Mr. Obama, and Mr. Harper took place before another meeting with the countries of Latin America, of the Americas. I think it's unfortunate that there's no more seriousness in this in approaching so many important issues. You mentioned the assault weapons ban that was raised in 2004. This is destroying Mexico. Mexico is turning into a lawless state. That's terrible. And I think it comes from the fact that many American politicians don't want to look at the consequences of their decisions outside of their border. But, you know, outside of the border, Mexico is within the United States. You know, in L.A., how many Mexicans originating from Mexico live in that area. And the same with Canada. And another thing that could have been raised, you know that the United States now has begun flying unmanned planes on the Canadian border, in the Dakota and Manitoba area, these drones. It's a bit insulting that two neighbors like Canada are building electronic fences and things like that. I think we should be like in Europe. When you go from France to Germany, there's no border. I don't think we should have borders for trade. I understand for immigration, there's a big problem of immigration in the United States and also Canada. We have a lot of immigration. But for trade, I mean, we should drop the red tape, drop the hassle, and make it more smoother for the benefit of all Canadians and all Americans.
Well, but, you know, unfortunately, these things become domestic political issues. The NRA is a powerful lobby. The right-wing Tea Party of the Republican Party is running on the anti-immigrant, yes, you know, ticket, if you will. And the Keystone Pipeline has become a political issue here in the United States in terms of domestic politics. The Republicans candidates are using it as a wedge to bash Obama. He's got to worry about his environmental constituency on the left. He's got to worry about his left in general because they're very disappointed in him. What do you think the deal is between him and Harper on Keystone?
Well, that pipeline, as you know, it's a big project that's been in the cards for at least 7 years. It's more than 2,000 miles long. It has been an issue in Canada for in two senses. First, many Canadians have said that pipeline will bring Canadian crude oil to American refineries in Illinois and in Texas, but it doesn't feed with Canadian refineries. So many Canadians see that as a project mainly to cater to the American needs. Another thing also is the fact that Canada may be too tied with the United States in regarding its oil exports. And that's why some people are proposing in Canada that there are more links with China and Asia in order to export Canadian oil, because Canada is one of the largest supplier of oil, at least if you consider the oil sands.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an issue on both sides of the border. On the U.S. side, there's a question of security of supply of oil. Of course, Canada is the most secure supplier of oil that you could find in the world outside of the United States. And President Obama, of course, has postponed the project until 2013, in other words, after the November election. So that pipeline will go on, and the government of Nebraska has proposed changes to the routes of that pipeline. It's a question of postponing. Of course, that brings costs to the promoters of that the project, but I have no doubt that that pipeline will be built.
But Roderick Tremblay, again, Professor Emeritus of Economics and International Finance at the University of Montreal, and he served as a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlements of the North American Free Trade Agreement, and is the author of The New American Empire and the Code for Global Ethics. But in Canada itself, I believe the environmentalists are very concerned about the environmental cost of extracting these oil from the tar sands, because it requires an enormous amount of water, enormous amount of energy to heat the water, and these high pressure steam hoses to separate the oil from the sand, and then the oil that presumably will go to America, but what's left in Canada is this brackish, oil-soaked water that's stored in these vast lakes that keep growing and growing and growing and growing. And some Canadian environmentalists I've talked to said at some point the value of the water might be greater than the value of the oil.
You're right. That's a third issue. And in northern Alberta, because tar sands are mainly in the north of Edmonton, Calgary is sort of the capital of Alberta, financial capital, and that's true. That uses a lot of resources, a lot of water, and in the future, maybe agriculture will be lacking supplies of water. Although Canada is probably the country in the world which has the most soft water supply. And, of course, in the West, they have less water than we have in the East. I'm from Montreal myself, and Quebec has 1 million lakes of water. But that's an issue. The problem is that the world needs energy, and as long as other energy supplies are not coming fast enough, it's very difficult to push oil completely out of the picture. So the government of Alberta is looking very closely. There's an election this year, as a matter of fact, in Alberta, and this is an issue that the voters of Alberta will have to decide.
And what about the idea of sending a pipeline across to the Pacific coast near Vancouver, or north of Vancouver, I believe, is the proposed route from the tar sands to supply China? I understand that the First Nations, native Canadians, are not too happy about this.
Yes, the Upper government has pushed for that alternative route. But you have first of all, you have to cross the Canadian Rockies. If you have crossed the U.S. Rockies, you know it's 30 miles wide. And you mentioned the Indian lands in B.C. But here again, so it's a question of route. They could have a different route and try to find a solution. Of course, these projects are always complex because so many agencies, so many governments are involved. But with goodwill, you can minimize the costs and maximize the benefits for everybody. I'm somewhat optimistic in that.
Well, just in closing, let me ask you a broad political question about this country's politics, particularly on the Republican side, are moving so far to the right. It's amazing. And there's, you know, Barack Obama said today that Ronald Reagan wouldn't have a chance in a Republican primary today. You've got a right-wing prime minister. But I take it a right-wing Canadian is way to the left of a right-wing American.
Well, you're pretty right. I follow American politics very closely because I have a blog that is devoted to American economic issues and American political issue, and it's called the Code for the Big Picture World. The Big Picture World. That's my code. My
site. Address, right?
You're right. I don't think Thomas Jefferson or John F. Kennedy could be elected nowadays in the United States, the way the climate is. And I think this has arisen when President Reagan canceled the fair doctrine of obtaining a license for radio and TV.
The fairness doctrine, yeah.
Yeah, the fairness doctrine kept a balance. Now you have a lot of opinions, a lot of propaganda, and the public, of course, is badly served by that polarizing. And you see that in Washington, there's no climate, no desire for compromise. Well, in a democracy, if you don't compromise, you are at war.
Sure. Well, Rodrigue Tremblay, I thank you. We've run out of time, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Very interesting talk to you.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Again, I'm speaking with Rodrigue Tremblay, Professor Emeritus of Economics and International Finance at the University of Montreal. He served as President of the North Economics and Finance Association, President of the Canadian Economic Society, was a member of the Committee of Dispute Settlements of the North American Free Trade Agreement. His books in English include The New American Empire and his latest, The Code for Global Ethics. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with the Politico's Ken Vogel. He's their chief investigative reporter, looking into this shadowy group called the Weaver Terrorist Group, which is led by Karl Rove. That's his address in Washington. These are where all the GOP money bundlers and kingmakers get together. They helped the Republicans retake the House in 2010, and they got some really big plans for 2012. He went through all the kind of players involved and the enormous amounts of money they're bringing to the table, and also explained some of the rifts between them. They're not all, curiously enough, Karl Rove is considered to be an establishment Republican, and the Koch brothers and some of the more radical Tea Party types don't trust him. So there's some question as to whether they'll unite around Mitt Romney. But the kind of money, the kind of secrecy that's provided by Citizens United really makes this whole situation appalling. And I frankly think that they're going to buy this next election. And then I spoke with Paul Starr, a Pulitzer Prize-winning sociologist at Princeton. He turns out to have a lot of. He was a senior advisor to Clinton's healthcare plan, if you will, and he also wrote this article in the New Republic. The healthcare mandate really was a mistake. We talked about that, and he made it pretty clear that that the president miscalculated about the courts, the politics, and the policy itself. All of these things could have been fixed. His new book, Remedy and Reaction, The Peculiar American Struggle Over Healthcare Reform, is definitely worth a read because it really does explain all of this complicated stuff. And, of course, the worst people to explaining the healthcare has been the Obama administration itself. Then finally, I spoke with a Canadian specialist, an economist, about what Harper and Obama were talking about at the White House yesterday and the future of the Keystone XL pipeline. He basically feels that this country has gone so far to the right, it's appalling, and that even a conservative in Canada would be, a liberal Democrat here in the United States. An interesting conversation. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbons. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Appeared by